You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
The government released our very first national adaptation plan yesterday, which gives advice and evidence for dealing with climate change. Today I spoke to Dr. Nick Craddock-Henry, the lead scientist of social ecological resilience at Manaaki Whenua, about the plan. And I started by asking him to give us an overview of the advice included in the plan.
I think that what the government sort of really lays out is it builds on the National Climate Change Risk Assessment, which was completed a couple of years ago. The NAP really sort of builds on that assessment, which kind of really identified the sort of key risks associated with climate change. And the NAP sort of starts to lay a bit of a high-level framework for how we might actually respond to those risks effectively, sorts of changes that might be needed in terms of infrastructure, particularly in terms of managing coastal hazards, as well as other sort of climate-related extremes, which are really going to present significant challenges for us in the coming decades.
And are there any highlights for you, things that you think were a really good thing to put in?
I think overall it's a step in the right direction. I think that in itself is something that we should definitely celebrate. Adaptation's long been sort of overlooked in terms of priorities. Mainly in terms of climate change, with respect to climate change, mainly in terms of mitigation. Most of our emissions come from agriculture, for example, and so over the last two decades, we've really invested a lot in trying to reduce or at least understand how to reduce those emissions. And adaptation has kind of kicked down the road for a number of years. So while the UK, for example, is releasing their third national adaptation plan next year, it's just gratifying to see New Zealand releasing our first, even if we are a little behind the times.
And are there any things that you think are lacking in the report?
Look, it's ambitious, high-level strategy. What's really needed is sort of place and problem and sector-specific information. The challenge is, you know, take coastal communities, for example. Some coastal communities where they're facing sea level rise, coastal erosion, and other sort of hazards. Some of those communities will be located in very affluent areas. They'll have lots of resources. They'll have lots of capital tied up in those homes. And other parts of the country, similar situations, you know, vulnerable coastal communities that will have much less access to information, far fewer resources at their disposal in terms of options to support adaptation. Looking at sort of the land-based primary industries as well. Similarly, you know, the types of challenges, the issues are going to be place-specific and problem-specific, and there'll be different barriers and enablers in each of those places. So I think that while the NAP provides good sort of overarching high-level guidance, we still need that sort of place and problem-specific information, and we really need to start to empower communities to be able to undertake a lot of that work themselves, simply because we don't have enough resource to go around. You know, there's certainly not enough in terms of the science, in terms of capacity in the science system. So how do we enable communities? How do we enable councils? And how do we resource them effectively in order to make some of these decisions themselves?
And on the topic of strategies that put the burden on the current generation, managed retreat is a phrase that comes up a lot in this discussion, definitely from the point of view of experts. But what is the general attitude to managed retreat, and maybe what are the reasons that some may be perturbed at the thought of doing that?
Oh, absolutely. It's a highly contentious issue. We have a significant coastline, where, I mean, we're essentially a coastal nation, and we have a long history of building homes and placing infrastructure in what are now increasingly vulnerable coastal areas. What are the issues? You know, iwi have marae, so there are significant cultural assets located in coastal areas, which have a strong cultural association. And so that is one issue. There are, as I mentioned earlier, there are thousands of homes located in coastal areas for the amenity values. People like to live near the ocean. They like to be near the beach. They like the views. Those homes have appreciated in value over the previous decades and especially over the last few years. And so when you are considering people's assets might be tied up in their home, and managed retreat would necessitate significant losses in capital appreciation, capital gains, as well as disruption to lives and livelihoods. It's very easy to see how this is an incredibly complex issue. It's sort of associated with managing levels of risk, but it's also people's values. And anytime you have a conflict between science, which might be, even in this case, the science is complex, but when you combine that with quite emotional, value-laden choices, making policy around those sorts of things is an increasingly fraught exercise. And I think that there is a real need to, it's good that we have at least put managed retreat on the table, and that we are talking about it, and it is getting some attention, which I think is a positive thing rather than sort of whispering about it behind closed doors. I think we're now beginning to have a bit of a free and frank discussion about what this might entail, how those costs associated with managed retreat will be shared, and to ensure that there are that it's done in an equitable fashion. As you say, there's going to be winners or losers, but how do we sort of reduce the likelihood or reduce that chance of there being too many winners and or too many losers, and we ensure that it's a bit more just and equitable, that transition.
Climate change is obviously a fluid issue, and it's a challenge that changes before our eyes. Are there any follow-up plans that are expected to be released, and is there expected frequency, if they exist, is that enough to keep up with the changing landscape?
Absolutely not. No, we're going to need to revisit this. So the science is changing, so we're understanding more and more with each successive model run what the likelihood of different impacts are going to be. We're understanding more and more about vulnerabilities in specific places for specific activities, all of which changes the sort of the risk profile and the metrics associated with that. I think we're also, as you've alluded to, we're also beginning to grapple with some of these issues that are maybe less clear-cut. You know, so we can, for example, so a lot of the emphasis over the last couple of decades, understandably, has been on the sort of risks associated with climate change. You know, what are the direct and indirect impacts of climate change? I think now what we're beginning to sort of grapple with as we move into this sort of conversation nationally about adaptation is how do we engage with these value-laden, complex social issues which have cultural aspects. They have aspects associated with individual well-being. There's health-related consequences, all of which, they're quite emotive decisions. They're quite emotive and fraught for policymakers. So we will absolutely need to revisit this as the science progresses, but as we mature as a society and as a society, we can actually have these complex, difficult conversations. I think that's going to be a real challenge going forward. And as I say, the UK is on their third national adaptation plan. And so this is the first generation for us. But I think it's just the beginning of what's going to be a very long road.
That was me speaking with Dr. Nick Craddock-Henry from Manaaki Whenua about the recently released National Adaptation Plan.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.